And that was a kind of taster, really, I suppose, of starting to help us to see how right throughout the whole of the Bible, men and women have sought the presence of God. And that is something, of course, we ourselves should be seeking today. And I hope Psalm 27 will help us with that, because it's one of the places in the Bible, perhaps, that most clearly expresses that desire to know the presence of God. But we're not going to just look at the verses that deal with the presence of God explicitly. We're going to look at the whole psalm, because the whole psalm, I think, helps us to understand how it is we can know and enjoy God's presence. So we'll split the psalm into five sections. The first section is in verses 1-3. And in that section, David speaks there of his confidence in God. Yeah, can you see that in the first three verses of Psalm 27? The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Now, we don't know exactly what time in David's life this psalm was written, but we do know from the rest of the Bible that David had a lot of enemies, didn't he? In fact, he talks of his enemies later on. We'll come to that shortly. But as he talks about his enemies, maybe he's thinking there of Goliath. What an enemy he was. Maybe he's thinking of King Saul, the king of Israel, who chased him around the nation, even into other countries, trying to kill him. Maybe he's thinking of his sons who rebelled against him towards the end of his life and again tried to do away with him. David had plenty of enemies at all times of his life. So when he says, "Whom shall I fear?" If you were around at the time, or if I was around at the time, we could have given David a list. You've got lots of people to fear, David. You've got all kinds of enemies. Enemies within your court, perhaps. Enemies without, all the kings in the neighbouring lands who would love to see you dead. You've got loads of people you should fear. But David doesn't fear. Why doesn't he fear? Well, he tells us even in verse 1, because the Lord is my light and my salvation. And towards the end of the verse, the Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? So he's not saying there's nothing scary going on. He's not saying there are no fearful people or fearful things. What he's saying is, compared to the Lord, compared to his strength, compared to his light, compared to his salvation, then I've got nothing to fear. And of course, that's something that's gloriously true for every believer in any situation and in every generation. You'll have things in your life that you fear, that you're afraid of. And some of those things, in a sense, you'll be right to fear. But actually, the Lord is the strength of your life. The Lord is your light and your salvation if you're trusting in him. And therefore, like David, we need not be afraid, not because there's nothing scary, but because the Lord is with his people. So he goes on to explain more about that in verses 2 and 3, to explain about the problems that he faces. The wicked might come against him to eat up his flesh, to kill him, as it were. Enemies and foes, though, it was they who stumbled and fell. How can you explain that? Except the Lord's hand. A whole army may come against me. They may encamp against me, set up stall, as it were, on his doorstep, ready to for a moment's weakness. Can you imagine waking up every morning and seeing the enemy camped out outside, just waiting for an opportunity to get you? That's what David faced at certain times. But he doesn't fear, even in a situation of war. He doesn't worry about that because he knows the Lord is bigger than his problems. He's got this great confidence in God. And it's easy perhaps for us to think, well, maybe David is overdoing it a bit. Maybe he's overconfident. He's too confident. With all these problems, surely he ought to be concerned about these things. But then the next section of the psalm, which I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, verses 4-6, tell us something of David's heart. So if the first three verses told us about his confidence in God, the next three verses, verses 4-6, tell us about his hope in God, and particularly his hope in God's presence. Because he's not actually telling us yet in verses 4, 5, and 6 what is true at the moment. He's not describing facts, as it were. He's sharing his heart with us. He's explaining to us and helping us to see what he longs for, what he prays for, what he works towards, what, as he puts it, is the one thing that he asks God for. Now, I'm sure that actually in reality, as it were, David had many things that he prayed for, but he's able to say in verse 3, one thing I've desired of the Lord, because this one thing is greater than all the other things. And maybe this one thing leads to all the other things, perhaps, that he may be praying for. So what's the one thing that he's desired of God? Verse 4. What's the one thing that he seeks? There it is in the middle of verse 4. That I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Now, David isn't saying here that, well, as I look out from my palace, if that's where he was, or from his farmhouse, or wherever he happened to be at the time when he wrote this psalm, I can see the tabernacle of God, you know, the one that Moses made in the Old Testament. Remember, David didn't live to see the temple being built. That was built after his time, so they had the tabernacle. David isn't saying here, do you know what, I'd love to get my airbed and move into the tabernacle. That's not what he's saying, is it? If he wanted to do that, certainly later in his life when he was king, he could have done that. But that's not what he means. What does he mean? Well, as we keep exploring verse 4, we'll see that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion, in the secret place of his tabernacle. So what is David longing for? He doesn't want to literally move in. He's using this idea of dwelling in the house of the Lord to symbolize and to represent his desire to be in God's presence. At the tabernacle of Moses' day, right up to David's day, the temples that followed, that was the place where God was set to dwell. That was the holy place and the holy of holies within the tabernacle and the temple. And in those places, that's where God's presence was. And that's where David wants to be. He wants to be in the presence of God in order that he might behold, see, in other words, the beauty of the Lord. Now, if David, let's imagine for a moment that David wasn't the king or a shepherd boy or whatever he was at this point in his life, but instead he was the high priest. Let's just imagine that. And if David was the high priest, he would be able to go not just into the tabernacle, but he'd be able to go into the holy place. And once a year, not just into the holy place, but into the holy of holies. So just imagine for a moment, David was a high priest. He wasn't, of course, he was a king, but let's imagine. And then on that day of atonement, imagine that he was able to go in, not just to the holy place, but to the holy of holies. What would he have seen there? What would he have seen? Well, if David was not an Israelite, but if he was an Assyrian or an Egyptian or someone from Tyre or Sidon or an Edomite or anywhere else in the ancient Near East, if he went into the center of the temple, he would have seen the God who was there. A great statue of a god towering over everybody. That's what he would have seen if he wasn't an Israelite. But he was an Israelite. And he worshipped the God of the Bible. And if David had gone into not just the holy place, but into the Holy of Holies, what would he have seen? Well, 1,000 or so years after David wrote this psalm, a Roman general conquered Jerusalem in 70 AD, and he heard all about the temple. Sorry, it wasn't 70 AD, it was earlier than that. He heard all about the temple, and as he conquered Jerusalem, he wanted to go inside the Holy of Holies. He'd heard all about it, and he went inside the Holy of Holies, this Roman general, and you know what? He left incredibly disappointed. And do you know what he said? There's nothing there. empty, as far as he was concerned, empty. Why? Because he was expecting to see a great God. But there was no God there, no physical God. And if David had gone into the tabernacle at this point, no statue, just the Ark of the Covenant, little box, that's all. No God. Nowhere, in other words, that he could see the beauty of the Lord physically. And of course, David knew that. He knew what was inside the tabernacle. Everybody knew that, or what was supposed to be there. Just empty. So when David talks about beholding the beauty of the Lord, again, he's not saying that this is to do with something physical. He understands that there's nothing physically to see of God. He's talking about God's nature and God's character. He's talking about seeing the beauty of his holiness, the beauty of his love, the beauty of his mercy, the beauty of his grace. In some ways, you don't need to go to a temple or a tabernacle to see that. You can see those things actually when your enemies are encamped around you. Perhaps you can see it particularly then. But David wanted to gaze on the beauty of the Lord. In times gone by, and I don't mean thousands of years ago now, I just mean hundreds, perhaps even just dozens of years ago, people used to talk about meditating. And in the past, when they talked about meditating, they didn't mean doing yoga and that kind of thing, as people tend to speak of it nowadays, of emptying your mind to avoid the stresses and the strains and the worries of everyday life. No, in times gone by, when people used to talk about meditating, it was the very opposite of what it means today, and much closer to biblical teaching. In times gone by, when people used to talk about meditating, they didn't mean emptying your mind, but they meant focusing your mind. And focusing your mind not on yourself, but on something outside yourself. We could say someone outside yourself, of God himself. And of thinking and of pondering of who God is. Meditation is a lost art in the 21st century, I think. It's something that we've forgotten even how to do. And if you're anything like me, if you try, as it were, to have a moment of quiet and of peace and try and think about God, your mind ends up being flooded with all kinds of other thoughts that seem to race in and leave no room for God. But David wanted to behold, to stand back and to look at God's beauty. We need to do that too. We need to meditate and to think about all that the Lord God has done. Maybe in David's time, he would think back to the Exodus and how God rescued his people from Egypt. Maybe, depending on when it was in his life, he might reflect on earlier times of his life. Perhaps if this was when he was a king, he might reflect back on killing Goliath and how God was with him there. He might think about knowing God's presence in all kinds of different situations. We can do the same. And of course, we too can look back not just to the Exodus, but to the cross, and see the love and the compassion and the majesty of God in all its beauty, as it were. But that lost art of meditation. I wish, to be honest, that I could share with you some great expertise that I've learned about meditating. But if I'm honest, I feel a beginner in it. I struggle with it maybe as much as some of you do. But what I can say is that if we're able to come before the Lord and with his help, that's crucial, isn't it? With his help, think concretely about the truth of God as we read of it in his word. And not just to read the words, but to ask ourselves, what does this teach us about our God? And as things come to mind, maybe it might teach us about the mercy of God, a particular passage, for example, particularly if we read in about the cross in the lead up to Easter. Well, this teaches us very much about the mercy of God. And then perhaps we can begin in our minds to think about what that means. We can think, well, are there occasions where I've particularly experienced mercy? And maybe things will come into your mind then. You'll be able to thank the Lord for the mercy that he's shown into you. Maybe you could ask yourself the question, well, are there other parts of the Bible that show me the mercy of God? And start to think about some of those things. And without needing any books other than your Bible, you'd be surprised perhaps just how much help you can get. But the point is, it's not an intellectual exercise merely. The point is, it's done in the presence of God. And when we find things, we're turning them into prayer, prayers of thanksgiving, prayers where we need mercy just to get through the day, and we'll start to pray for that. And that's a beginner's guide to meditation, perhaps. David, I'm sure, was exploring more depth than all of that. But he's got this hope in God's presence, and this, he wants to inquire in his temple. It's not a passive thing. That's what I'm trying to get with this meditation. It's an active thing. It's in communion with God, almost a conversation, as it were, a two-way journey of thoughts expressed to God, things we're learning from God's word. Excuse me. And David knows and believes that as he goes about this and seeks the Lord's presence, then when the time of trouble comes, the Lord will hide him in his pavilion, another word for tabernacle or temple. In the secret place he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock, and his head will be lifted up above his enemies. The idea seems to be, again, if he's close to God, maybe a little bit like Moses was at the top of Mount Sinai last week, if he's like that, he'll be able to look down on his enemies. Now, I don't have enemies in the sense that David did, as far as I know at least. Nobody out to kill me or to usurp me or anything like that, as far as I know. I don't have enemies in that sense. But just like you, I have problems and struggles and stresses and worries and so on. And sometimes it can feel as though those things get on top of you, can't they, and push you down. And what David is saying here is, well, if we're in God's presence, then there's a very real sense in which God will lift us up. That instead of our problems pressing down on us, we'll, as it were, be able to, as if being on the top of the mountain, be able to overlook. And sometimes if you're lifted high above, isn't it, what seems like a great problem that you are in, you can see your way out of it then. It looks quite a small thing, perhaps, that problem that you faced. Have you ever, even just on the little, then they're not even mountains, are they really? Just the hills up around here. Gathlionen or whatever it might be, and you've gone up onto the hills and tried to find your house. We've done that a few times down in Clydach, and it just looks so small. And of course, if you were on Snowdon, you wouldn't be able to see your house on Snowdon, but it's the houses there, they're just tiny. That's how it is if we're with the Lord, that he lifts us up above our problems. Our problems seem so tiny compared with where the Lord has put us. And it's no surprise, therefore, that he sings praises to the Lord at the end of verse 6. And we can do that too, sing praises to God. When Moses was younger, and we used to have to sometimes be up in the night with him, and sometimes if we were struggling to get him back to sleep, we'd sing to him. And he's the only person I've ever met who likes my singing. And I used to sing to Moses. But I'm not very good at remembering the words of hymns. I kind of, you know, I'll start with verse 1 and then I'll end up halfway through verse 4. And I'll get confused, and even things like Amazing Grace that I do know, I struggle sometimes to sing it without the words. And so I got a hymn book out and used to keep it downstairs where we would sing quietly to Moses. And I really enjoyed, actually, singing through the hymn book. And after a little while of singing the kind of old favourites again and again, I started at hymn number 1. And I'm working my way through the hymn book. I think it'll take about 5 years to get through it, because I don't sing a hymn every day. And there's nearly 1,000 in there. But that's my aim, to sing through the hymn book if I can. And actually, sometimes singing those songs that I've never sung before helps you to think of things in a fresh way. And sometimes, of course, singing an old favourite that you love and has maybe been very significant in your life can again help you to meditate on the Lord. It might remind you of a time in the past when the Lord has been good. But singing praises to the Lord, it's wonderful to do that on a Sunday and on a Wednesday together. But we don't, don't have to keep it just for then. We can sing any time. And whether you use a hymn book or sing along to a CD, in that sense doesn't matter. But to sing praises to the Lord ought to be part of our daily experience, not just part of our weekly experience. So we've seen confidence in God, 1-3, hope in God's presence, which we spent a little bit more time on 4-6. And now the third section there, verses 7-10, a prayer for God's presence, a prayer for God's presence. So in verses 7, we can see now that David is not just describing about the Lord, as he did at the beginning, or describing about his desires, as we've just seen, but now he's praying to the Lord explicitly. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. Have mercy also upon me and answer me. Now again, just on that verse, can you see again this idea of a two-way connection? People who are not Christians, and maybe some people perhaps who've come from maybe a more Catholic background or a more formal church background, perhaps don't really fully understand this idea of prayer as being two-way, but it is. It always is in the Bible. So perhaps a lot of people have got this idea of prayer that we kneel down and we put our hands together or whatever it is. We might light a candle in some traditions, whatever happens, and we say some words. And they kind of float off to the ceiling there. And well, then we've prayed and then we go our own way. But that's not what prayer looks like in the Bible. It's not what prayer looks like here in this psalm. Because David here is praying that God would answer. And very often I think we make a mistake when we talked about God answering prayer. We tend to mean by that God gives us what we've asked for. And that's the answer. But I'm not sure prayer's really just about that. The purpose of prayer is not to get something at the end of it. Now, there will be elements of asking God for things in our prayers. Don't misunderstand me. But prayer is much more than that. Prayer is about praise. So let me ask you, if you prayed a prayer that was only full of praise to God, you didn't ask for anything, how would God answer that prayer? Most people would say, well, he can't answer that prayer because you haven't asked him for anything. But he can. And I believe does. Because God answers prayer not simply by giving us what we ask for, but God answers prayer in the sense that prayer is a two-way thing. Now I'm not suggesting that you're going to hear God's audible voice or exact words. But I am saying, as verse 8 goes on to say, when you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, Lord, I will seek. Now look at verse 9. Do not hide your face from me. So what's David saying here? David's saying, I'm seeking your face, Lord, but actually, I'm expecting, I'm hoping, I'm praying for something in return. What am I praying for in return? That the Lord won't turn his face away. The implication is he'll turn his face towards David. He will sense and enter into God's presence. It's a two-way thing. He's seeking God's face and he's expecting that God will at the very least not turn his face away. And the implication is that he will turn his face towards the Lord. In verse 11, if we were to just jump there, jump ahead of ourselves for a while, again, he's asking God, teach me your way. Now David isn't here expecting that next day some prophet will turn up with some instructions for David. That's not what he's talking about here. He wants to understand and to have this sense of God. In verse 14, again, just jumping ahead, he says to everybody now, wait on the Lord. As if there's a sense in which you can wait to know this from God. And that can only mean, if we can wait on the Lord, that can only mean that when God does respond with his presence, we'll know it's happened. And as it were, it's time to stop waiting because the Lord has responded in this way. He shall strengthen your heart. These are tangible things. Now, It's hard, if I'm honest, to talk about and to describe spiritual, tangible things. Perhaps it almost seems like a contradiction. Because you can't see and touch God's presence. But because you and I are not just bodies, not just minds, but we are bodies and souls, our souls can sense God's presence and know God's presence. And our souls, as it were, can commune with God, even if our eyes do not see him and our ears do not hear him. That's the spiritual reality of the Christian life and the life of the Old Testament believer. And maybe for many of us, our souls aren't, can I use the expression, in tune with God? Perhaps some of you can remember the old rotary dial radios, particularly if you were trying to pick up shortwave or something like that, before you had the kind of automatic scan ones that would tune you in automatically. And certainly if the weather wasn't great and your aerial wasn't great, and you would struggle sometimes to pick up the signal, and you'd get near to it, and then you'd maybe have to sort of fine-tune it and adjust it to tune in. And I hope you understand the illustration. It's not a perfect one, I know. When it comes to our spirits and knowing God's presence, that sometimes we have this kind of vague sense, but there's a lot of static, a lot of noise coming from the world and our worries and concerns. And we can kind of hear God's voice as a dim and distant echo, a bit like listening to a medium wave station driving through a tunnel. And we need God's help. And frankly, often we need practice to be able to tune into God. And sometimes if you've ever again tried to listen to a radio station and the batteries are going in the radio, the power's waning and it's kind of fading out and fading away. Sometimes spiritually we can be like that too, lack strength and power. And we don't know God's presence. We don't hear God's voice. And we're weakened by it. I think that's one of the reasons why David ends as he does, asking for strength. Strength. So do you understand what David is helping us to see here? This idea, not just of one-way communication, us talking to God, but of something two-way, something that goes back and forth, something that we can sense and know. And maybe at different times you've had the experience of, this doesn't happen every time, I don't think anyone prays, but it does happen from time to time that you'll pray, and maybe you've been praying fervently for something for days, weeks, or even months, and perhaps all of a sudden you'll get a sense in which you can stop praying now, and you can turn your prayers to thanksgiving because God is going to answer that prayer. And there may be nothing tangible in the sense that you can point to, but just this sense within your soul, within your spirit, that you believe that God has answered that prayer. I don't think that happens every time we pray by any stretch, but it's an example again of the sort of thing that we're talking about here when we're talking about the presence of God. And that's what David is praying for here, to praying that God would respond to his prayers and that he might know God's presence. You've been my help, he says, verse 9. Do not leave me or forsake me, O God of my salvation. And then you have this lovely verse 10. We've talked before about memorizing Bible verses. That's another lost art, isn't it, in our own day. But Psalm 27, verse 10, along, I think, with verse 4, are worth trying to commit to memory. When my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me. It's a beautiful verse. So confidence in the Lord, verses 1 to 3, hope in God's presence, 4 to 6, prayer for God's presence, 7 to 10, now 11 to 13, more briefly. David now sort of wraps things up, as it were, and talks again about his hopes and his prayers. It's his conclusion, his summary. What does he ask for? Verse 11, teach me your way, O Lord, lead me in a smooth path because of his enemies. Do not deliver me to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and as such breathe out violence. Do you remember I was saying earlier, when David was talking about he had no need to be afraid, that he had enemies? Well, here they are. And he knows that. He's got these enemies. And he's finishing off by saying, well, how can I cope? How have I coped this far? The only reason I've coped with all my difficulties and with all my problems, David says in verse 13, is because I believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. I believed I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. All that's taken David forward, therefore, is his hope and his trust in God. His confidence that God hasn't abandoned him. And even though at the moment things seem pretty desperate, he's confident that he will see the goodness of God. And that is what keeps him going. And it may be that you and I will face days like this, when everything just seems overwhelming and we'll wonder how we're even going to get to the end of the day, never mind the end of the week. And in those moments, our faith that we will see the goodness of God in the land of the living will keep us going too. Now, I don't know here in verse 13 whether David is talking about simply knowing God's presence right now, as it were, in this life, or whether he's also thinking here that there is another land of the living, as it were, still to come. But either way, that the point is clear. His confidence, not in himself but in God, is what keeps him going forward. So as the psalm ends then in verse 14, and this is the final brief section, David has a message now, not for himself, not for God, but a message for us. It's an instruction. It's the epilogue, as it were. It comes at the end. Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. And then that reminder, wait, I say, on the Lord. So here's what David says, wait. 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 Why does he need to tell us that? He needs to tell us that because the things that he's been describing and the things that he's been talking about don't come quickly and don't always come easily. And you and I, perhaps like David, are prone to give up. Give up before we get to the end. I remember as I was an A-level student sitting an exam, and it was a really hard exam. And I was struggling, I think most people were struggling, truthfully. And I remember very clearly one of the lads in the class, after about half an hour, throwing down his pen and stomping out of the exam room. That was it. He'd had enough. Now, what happened? Well, at the end of that exam, most of us had struggled on. And I have no idea what grade we got now, but we did enough to get through. But this lad, who'd thrown down his pen after half an hour, well, he had to do the whole thing all over again, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He had to go through the resit, as it were. And it was only when he'd had the patience and the endurance to go through till the end that he got what he wanted. And I think very often we do the same. The Lord perhaps puts us through tests and sometimes through trials. And in the trial, he wants us to call on him. And we do. But then, well, we live in an instant world, don't we? Not just instant coffee, but instant communication and instant everything else. And if you're like me, you want some information from the other side of the world, click on a link in your web browser. If it takes more than 5 seconds, well, something's wrong. Hit refresh and fiddle with the wire. Try and get your signal better. It should be here by now. That's what we're like. But it's not what God's like. And sometimes, well, not just sometimes, always, in fact, the best things in life take time. The best things in life take time. And therefore, we do need to wait on the Lord, to pause, to stop, to be patient. It's one of the virtues of a Christian, isn't it? And to be of good courage, in other words, to be confident. We may think because we've waited for 5 seconds and we haven't heard anything, the Lord isn't coming. But he will come. David was confident about that. So we need these two things. If we're not confident in God, we probably won't wait long enough to know a real strong sense of God's promise and God's presence. So we need, together and on our own, to wait on the Lord. And if we do, then he will strengthen your heart. You will know his presence. He will help you in your struggles and your problems. But wait, I say, on the Lord.